Site 2. Unit 5. Crossing the channel. 5.1. Inside the channel tunnel.
Euroroute is a scheme that operates at much lower running costs than the channel tunnel. What happens is this. Most bridges go from each coast, 10 kilometres out from the coast, and connect up with a 20 kilometre submerged concrete tube tunnel made on two man-made islands in the English Channel. The roadways spiral gently down to the level of the tunnel. It's the same principle as the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel in the USA, and it's well-researched technology. Thinking ahead to the 21st century, I believe that people will prefer, well, will want to drive across, not queue up waiting for trains. And finally, there are also two separate supplementary rail-only tunnels, and they can take up to 30 high-speed passenger and freight trains in each direction per hour.
The Channel Expressway is a scheme consisting of two tunnels which carry both road and train traffic. The rails are laid flush with the road surface, like tracks in the fast lane, which is closed to traffic once every half hour, trains to pass through. Really, both the passenger trains and the freight trains are able to use the tunnel, but the freight trains will mostly run during the night when there's less road traffic. There will be special pumps at regular intervals along the tunnel to clean the air and remove the exhaust fumes from it.
FlexiLink is the cheapest and most reliable scheme of them all, really. Ferries, especially the new giant super ferries, are more economical, safer, and a lot more flexible than building a tunnel. And they're also friendlier to the environment. For the motorist and the lorry driver, the pleasurable experience of strolling on the deck with time to enjoy a meal and take a relaxing brake journey is much more pleasant than the claustrophobic sensation of being underground for an hour and the idea of, you know, being trapped. Time saved for cars and road freight by building the tunnel is less than an hour. Insignificant saving on journeys of 12 hours or more. There's no doubt that ferries will continue operating in competition with the tunnel, both on the short channel cross and on the longer crossings from southern England to France and England to Holland, Belgium, Germany and Scandinavia.
5.3. Connecting or protecting?
Well, I'd like to tell you about the building of the Panama Canal. There were three other important ship canals, the Suez Canal, the Kiel Canal, and the Houston Canals. Now, they're all at sea level, but the Panama Canal is different. It rises to 26 metres and has huge locks. It's 82 kilometres long. Now, it takes between 24 to 30 hours for a ship to pass through the canal. But it does save 8,000 nautical miles of journeying round Cape Horn. The project was first started by a French company under a man called Ferdinand de Lesseps in 1879. But thousands of men died of yellow fever and malaria, which at the time were thought to be caused by the climate, not mosquitoes, which is quite interesting. And this led to work being abandoned in 1889. So they did 10 years of working on it before abandoning it. Then the United States of America bought part of the Republic of Panama and began construction in 1906. The chief engineer at the time was a man called John F. Stevens. But, however, the main contributor to the success of the scheme was not the chief engineer, but was the medical officer, a man called Colonel William C. Yorgas, who eradicated yellow fever and reduced the incidence of malaria. The total cost of the canal was $380 million, with 43,000 labourers, who were mostly black West Indians. The canal was first opened in 1914 and consists a series of lakes connected by canals and locks with specially built locomotives to pull ships through the locks. Lake Gatton at the top supplies the water for the canals. They had to cut down a lot of jungles and that has affected the climate of the area. There is a lack of water at some times of the year. Now, this, unfortunately, is likely to get worse as the lake fills up silt and earth. The canal zone itself was politically part of the United States of America and until it was given back to the Panamanian Republic in 1977. But the canal will revert to Panamanian control in in the year 2000.
Did you know that the Great Wall of China is the only human structure that can be seen from space? It's 3,460 kilometres long, and it's wide enough for chariots and carts to travel along the top. It was built around 221 BC, on the orders of Shi Huang Ti, the first great emperor of China, and it was to protect the northern frontier of China and keep out hostile tribes. 500,000 labourers were needed to build it, and its nickname was the longest cemetery in the world because so many died building it. And this emperor, Shi Huang Ti, was the first Qin emperor, and he united China for the first time, giving it its name. As well as that, he introduced a standard form of the Chinese written language throughout the empire, and he also had a mausoleum built for himself containing 6,000 soldiers made of pottery with terracotta. This took 700,000 labourers 36 years to build, and is actually larger than the pyramids of Egypt. In addition to that, he also burned all the books in his empire, and he buried his political opponents alive.
Now, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco opened in 1937, cost $35 million. It's still the world's tallest bridge. It's high enough for the largest ships in the world to pass underneath. It's about 80 meters above the sea. Now, the main span of 1,280 meters has three lanes in each direction, and it connects San Francisco with Marin County, replacing all the ferries that used to cross over, or otherwise you'd have to make a journey completely around San Francisco Bay. Now, the chief engineer was a guy called Joseph B. Strauss, and the building of the bridge was really a tremendous technical achievement because they had a blasted rock under the water. Under really deep water, because, of course, in San Francisco there's lots of earthquakes, and they had to make it earthquake-proof. And there were storms all the time, and fog, and even the ship collided with the bridge, and it caused some really serious damage.
Unit 6. Buildings and Homes. 6.1. Where do you live?
I like my present home because it's in the suburbs, in that there are a lot of trees around it. But it's only about half an hour's ride from the center of town. And it's got this ridiculous patch at the end of the garden that's owned by my next-door neighbor that has ducks and chickens and geese, who are like guard geese and who quack in the night if there are strangers about. I like that.
I like my present home because it's a flat near the city, about 10 minutes out of the city. And that's convenient for getting in, for cycling in, which is what I do. And it's also got a lot of amenities close to it. There's a swimming pool, cinema, library, theatre. It's some very good markets as well, fruit and vegetable and clothes. And that's why I like the present flat that I've got. If I had a lot of money, I'd keep the flat that I've got in London, and I'd buy one out in the country, probably up north, which is where I came from originally. In fact, I could probably buy a house up there if I had a lot of money. So that's what I'd do. I'd have the two places, one for a pied-à-terre in London and one for going up to at the weekends.
I wouldn't mind moving home if I had enough money to move into the country and live in the sort of house I really like to live in. Something really old, with lots of land. Preferably a beach to wander on in the mornings. Yes, I'd move home to that.
The main differences between homes in North America and Britain are really two, size and height. Homes in North America tend to be a little bigger, I suppose, because they don't cost quite so much in most places. And secondly, they don't go up quite so frequently. They spread out, whereas homes in Britain tend to be built on one, two, three stories, perhaps.
The main differences between homes in North America and Britain are you've got screen doors in North America to keep the flies out, and it's not warm enough in Britain usually to have flies. The heating in Britain is terribly important. It's less so in America. We use underfloor heating there.
I like my present home because it's in the country to start with and surrounded by fields, and because it's sort of the end of a no-through road, so very few people drive past. It's on an old dirt track. I hear them when they do. And because it's an old cottage and I like got no wire and things like that. I'm a bit of a romantic. If I had a lot of money, I'd keep the house I've got, but I'd get a nice flat in the middle of London, another one in the middle of Cardiff, because I work in those two places, and I think a small chalet in the Alps. That'd do me.
My ideal living room would contain absolutely everything that you need for everyday life. In fact, it would even have the bed in it, because I cannot stand having to go upstairs and downstairs, having left something that I needed upstairs to bring back down. So I have all mod cons and every single thing you could imagine that you might need throughout the day there.
6.2. Do you see what I mean? 1. What do you think about modern architecture?
Well, in my view, it totally fails to take into account the human scale of things. It's almost as if people don't count anymore. See what I mean? I think architects should be made to consider what it's like to live or work in the building that they design. In fact, I think they should actually have to live in their own buildings. Don't you think?
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more.
2. What are your views on living in the country, as opposed to living in the city?
Well, I'd say that for most people it's just not practical. I think it'd be awful to be living in the middle of nowhere. Do you see what I mean?
No. I'm sorry, can you explain why?
Well, you'd be cut off from all the amenities of urban life, supermarkets and cinemas, shops, theatres, things like that. Part of your life would be missing. Well, don't you agree?
That's one way of looking at it, I suppose.
3.
What are your feelings about living with your parents? Well, it seems to me that for most young people it's something they have to do. And, well, they just have to come to terms with it. People have to adjust to, you know, living together, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yes, yes, I see.
Would you agree that even if you don't get on with your parents, you've just got to put up with it while you're young?
Well, no. No, not entirely.
4.
So what are your feelings about the building of the Channel Tunnel?
Well, the way I see it, the whole project is ridiculous, okay?
No, I don't quite follow. I mean, do you mean the cost is too high?
No! I just mean it's dangerous. What if there's a fire and you're there trapped under tons of water? No, you'll never persuade me to go in a train under the ocean.
I think I see what you mean. But if we don't have a chance...
5.
What do you think about nuclear power?
Well, if you ask me, it's the only sensible ecological solution to the world's energy problems, right?
No, I'm not quite with you. Are you saying that nuclear power is safe? Now, you can't mean that.
Oh, but I do. Burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide, which is contributing to the greenhouse effect. It's both safer and cheaper to generate electricity in nuclear power stations.
That's true in a way, I suppose.
6.
Hey, what do you think of John and Mary's new flat?
Well, you know, I can't help thinking they kind of made a mess of the decoration, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. There's rainbow colours in the living room.
I mean, if you're decorating a room, it's supposed to be relaxing and calm.
Mm-hmm.
Bright red and yellow and blue, well, it just makes you feel restless and uncomfortable.
That's true.
Unit 7. Put it in writing. 7.2. Spoken and written English. 1.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is to compare two very common styles of English. First of all, rapid conversational style. That is the kind of English that's used when you're having a conversation with some friends or with some colleagues. And on the other hand, I want to talk about formal written style. That is the kind of English that's used in business letters, reports, textbooks, things like that. And I'm going to refer to the former as speech in this lecture. Of course, there are other kinds of speech as well, obviously. And the latter as writing, though obviously there are other kinds of writing as well, many other styles. So, various points I want to make. First of all, speech. Now, rapid conversational English is face-to-face. It happens when you can see someone, and that is part of what is going on, the way that you can see what's happening and the other person can see what's happening. It's unplanned. You don't know what you're going to say until you say it. And it's spontaneous. Secondly, writing is different because formal written English happens alone. If you could actually see someone, you wouldn't bother to write to them. It happens alone and it's planned. You don't write something until you've thought what you're going to write. Now, what I want to do now is to look at the main features of speech that you don't get in writing. Explain that one of the things that doesn't happen in writing, but actually when you're listening to someone, you may not always notice it. You can probably notice what I'm doing now because I'm sort of trying to exaggerate this particular phenomenon that happens in conversation. And I'm sure you can all in the gap in this sentence. What I'm doing now a lot is hesitating. Now, hesitation is something which happens all the time in conversation, but in writing it doesn't happen. That doesn't mean to say that when you're writing, you write and write and write. Of course not, because when you're writing, if you need to stop and think, if you need to find the right word, or if you need to look something up, or find out some information, you stop writing. You put the pen down, you stop typing, or whatever it is. In other words, hesitation in writing is invisible, but hesitation in conversation is audible. You can always hear it, and some people hesitate more than others. What I was doing just now was hesitating more than I would normally do. The second feature is what I could call listener contact. Now, listener contact is the way in which, in a conversation, the people involved are always somehow communicating with each other during the interaction. And a typical example of this is the use of what are called question tags. Questions as well, actually. You know, question tags, those things like isn't it and don't you and can't you. I often think this is something like a sort of tennis match where someone is serving the ball to the other one. You know, it's a lovely day today, isn't it? Oh, yes, it's wonderful. It's nice yesterday too, wasn't it? Oh, yes, and I think it's going to be nice tomorrow, don't you? And so the ball goes backwards and forwards in the conversation. In other words, people are throwing the conversation over to each other. Now, listener contact goes on in other ways as well, obviously. In this lecture that I'm giving now, I'm keeping in contact with you while I'm lecturing. I'm not looking at my notes, reading word for word what it's here. I'm looking at the reactions I'm getting. We're keeping in touch with our eyes. In a lecture, you can't sort of talk back to me and involve yourself in a conversation, but when I've finished at the end, you'll probably have some questions, and that's your way of contacting me about communication that's gone on between us. And the eye contact, as I said, is very important there. Now, eye contact is something which we could also describe as silent language, and this is the next point, really. An important part of speech is the stuff that you can't actually hear. If you're listening to a recording of something, if you listen to a recording of this lecture, there are various going on that you can see, but a listener wouldn't be able to notice. I mean, things like me doing this. Well, you know I'm scratching my head, but the listener wouldn't have a clue and wouldn't know that I meant I'm puzzled or I can't think what to do next. And if I point at something and say, look at this, then you can see what I'm pointing at and you know what it is. But someone just hearing it wouldn't have a clue. In other words, the kind of thing that's going on in a conversation, even the kind of thing that's going on in a lecture like this, is essentially not just sounds happening, but vision as well. And you don't get it in writing. And it's also missing on the phone, isn't it? When you're on the phone to someone, if you want to draw attention to something, it's no good pointing at it and saying, look at this. It's no good sort of waving your arms about and saying, this is very important, because the person on the other end of the line can't see what you're doing. If you look at people in telephone boxes, you often see them waving their arms about and pointing at things, because they can't help it. It's part of what you're doing when you're talking.
7.5. Writing letters.
When did you last write a personal letter? Do you write lots of letters? Are you one of those people who prefer to pick up the phone? Sally James has some thoughts about letter writing.
In Britain, the number of private letters sent, that is, letters sent from one private address to another, was 1,000 million in 1900. This had risen to 3,000 million in 1930, but in 1980 dropped to an all-time low of 650 million. Now, the good news is that this figure has been rising every year since then, so that now 700 million personal letters are written every year. So people do still write letters. Even though it's easy to pick up the phone to get in touch with someone, it's much cheaper to write a letter. Many people prefer to compose their thoughts and ideas in writing. People look forward to receiving letters. They often reread them and keep them to read again later. The results of a survey among 16 to 24-year-olds have just been published. Now, according to this, 22% of the letters they write are thank you letters, 19% are sent to addresses abroad, 12% are fan letters sent to pop stars or film stars, 5% are letters to grandparents, and 29% are love letters. Among the people surveyed, it was discovered that the women wrote twice as many letters as men. Among the whole population of all age groups, women write 20 letters per year and men only 10 letters per year. Now, most of the letters that are sent are business letters. In the UK, 70% of all letters delivered in the UK are connected with business in some way. Circulars, or bills, or straightforward business letters. Between companies, business letters are still being written, in spite of the new technology of fax and electronic mail. Business people tend to prefer letters because they enable them to keep a permanent record of transactions, positions, and a good-looking, well-written letter is appreciated by clients and a useful part of marketing strategy in many companies. Quite simply, people like receiving letters. In business, the number of fax messages has overtaken the number of telex messages. Generally, a fax is cheaper to send and much quicker to write and reply to. And you can handwrite a fax message if you're in a hurry. The main advantage of fax and telex is, of course, speed. Even if you send a letter airmail, it may not arrive for several days or even several weeks in some countries. So, for communication between continents, it makes sense for businesses to fax or telex each other. And a high-quality fax can look attractive, just like a letter anyway, and contain illustrations or diagrams and even photos. Much more impressive than a scruffy telex. One day, the experts say, everyone will probably have a fax machine connected to their phone, and they'll be able to fax letters to each other instantaneously instead of posting them and waiting for the postman to deliver them. We'll probably write far more personal letters in future, but we won't be popping them in the postbox. We'll be faxing them to each other. Love letters by fax? I hope not, because it's so nice to find a handwritten envelope addressed to you among all the bills and circulars, or to receive a postcard with an exciting foreign stamp on it, and know that someone cares enough about you to want to write to you. Oh, that's the postman now. Excuse me, I'm expecting a letter.
Unit 8. Those were the days. 8.4. 1499.
Good evening. We have with us in the studio two people who have recently come back from Asia. Mr. Vasco da Gama.
Hello.
Who has just returned from India. And Mr. Christopher Columbus.
Hello, everyone.
Who has just returned from his third voyage to the east coast of Asia. Mr. da Gama, you set off from Lisbon in July 1497, didn't you?
Yes, July the 8th it was. July the 8th, if I remember rightly. Now, I set off and I took with me 170 crew and also provisions for approximately 3 years, just to make sure, you see. Now, the longest leg of the journey was a 6,000-kilometre stretch between the Cape Verde Islands and the Cape of Good Hope. We were out of sight of land for 93 days. A long time. Anyway, now, on the way, I managed to deal with some rather unfriendly Muslim rulers on the east coast of Africa. And then, another long sea voyage of about 23 days across the Arabian Sea. Well, we arrived in India on May the 22nd last year. And, thanks to my skills as a diplomat, we got on good terms with the ruler of Calicut.
Could I just come in here for a minute, Robin?
Oh, yes, certainly, Mr. Columbus, yes.
Isn't it true, Vasco, that Bartolomeo Diaz first sailed round the southern tip of the African continent in 1488, 10 years earlier than you, and if his crew hadn't refused to carry on further across the Indian Ocean, that he got there first?
But he didn't, and that's the point. Anyway, we left Calicut late August 1498, loaded with lots of spices, drugs, silk and precious stones.
You didn't get back till this September, did you? Why did it take so long?
Well, in fact, we were delayed by contrary winds and difficulties en route, you see. Unfortunately, only 55 members of my crew survived.
Oh, why was that?
Because of scurvy.
Still, it is a fantastic achievement, and it looks as though you've opened up an important new trading route with the Orient.
Yes.
Now, Christopher Columbus, you've just returned from your third voyage, I think.
Yes, that's right, Rob. And I think that in the long run, my discovery of the east coast of Asia will be more significant than Vasco's little trip.
Perhaps you could remind our listeners about your previous trips.
Yes, certainly, Robin. Well, most educated people believe that the Earth is round, of course. Mm-hmm. And you do too, don't you, Vasco? And so you just have to keep going west to reach Japan and the Indies. Well, I couldn't persuade the King of Portugal to finance the trip in 1484, so in the end I had to go next door to Spain and get the money from King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. That was 8 years later, and I have to tell you that I had to do a big selling job on them because they hesitated quite a lot before deciding they would finance my incredible voyage. So I left Spain on the 2nd of August, 1492. A lot of people were leaving Spain that day. You may remember it was the same time that all the Jews were drift Spain. Anyway, we left the 2nd of August. In 92, we had three ships and 90 men. Well, I decided to go via the Canary Islands so that I could pick up the winds to carry us off to the west. Now, on this first voyage, we were out of sight of land for 36 days from the Canary Islands to the Indies. That's a distance of 4,000 kilometers, Robin. Mm. We reached the other side of the ocean on October the 12th of that year, and we explored one or two of the islands. Obviously, these are islands off the coast of China or Japan.
Now, you arrived back in Spain in March 1493, yes, with a small amount of gold, mm-hmm. six local residents from the island.
Yes.
You call them Indians, yes?
Indians is right, Robin, yes.
Yes, and some parrots. Not quite the gold mine you had promised, sir.
That may be true, maybe not, but that was early days, remember. I'd proved it could be done, and that is the main point, if I may say so, Robin. Now, my second voyage began 6 months later. This time, I had 1,200 men. I set up the first European settlement on the other side of the Atlantic. Do not forget that. My third voyage began on the 30th of May last year.
Yeah, and what was the purpose of this third voyage?
To discover a sea passage through to the Indies.
And did you?
Well, to be quite frank with you, no. But we did discover a huge river, and we sailed all along the coast of Asia looking for a route through it or around it. Now, the trouble is that land appears to block the through route to the Indies, but I am convinced that if we can find a route, then it's only a few days sailing to get to the Indies.
So, what are your plans for the future?
Of course, I've already started organizing a fourth voyage, and this time I'll sail through to India. I'll see you there, Vasco.
I rather doubt it, Chris.
Mr. Da Gama, Mr. Columbus, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
8.6. Spoken and written English. 2. You'll hear the second part of a lecture. You heard the first part of this in Unit 7.
You look at people in telephone boxes, you often see them waving their arms about and pointing at things, because they can't help it. It's part of what you're doing when you're talking. Okay, next point is to do with stress and intonation and pausing. Now, when you're using language, you're talking, to make the message clear, you sometimes emphasize things by saying this is very important. or you may pause in order to perhaps also have the same effect. This is very, for it, important. In writing, we have to do something different, because you can't sort of make a long space before the next word. What you can do is something else, though. You can perhaps print it boldly, or underline it, or print it in italics, in capitals. There are other techniques used for the same effect. But one thing tricky, I think, about the way that it's sometimes difficult to relate the two styles we're talking about is when we come to the question of feelings and attitude. Now, when people are talking, especially if they're talking in a conversation, especially if they're getting worked up about something, feeling emotional about something, then their voice carries not just information in the words they're using, but also information in the tone that they're using, the way their voice sounds. Now, in writing, the words that are used are just words on a page. There's no way of knowing if the writer is angry at a particular time, or timid at a particular time, or nervous at a particular time. And so what we have to do, and what I suppose is necessary, for example, in things like novels or stories, is to somehow get over the idea that there is a tone involved in the way things are actually spoken. I mean, let's say someone just says thank you. In a novel, that might be written as he said. If someone says thank you, a novel, it might say he said in an angry voice. Thank you. In a novel, it might say thank you, he said timidly. Did you say that was timidly? Or
thank you.
In a novel, that would be thank you, he whispered, wouldn't it? In a novel, and in stories, very often special words are used, like whispered, shouted, in an angry voice, he yelled, he said sarcastically, in order to reflect the tone that is used in speech. Right, there are just two more points I'd like to make. In fact, these are probably the two most important points of all. Anyway, first of all, let me just say a few words about vocabulary. Let's just take some examples of vocabulary. For example, in speech, the use of things like phrasal verbs is very common. And the use of descriptive adjectives is not as common as it is in writing. Now, if I say to you, I had a very nice meal, and you say, okay, that's interesting, fine, then I know I've got my message across. But if I say, I had a very nice meal, you say, what do you mean, nice? Was it delicious? Was it interesting? Was it entertaining? Were the people fun? You can come back and ask me questions. In writing, you can't do that. Because it's a one-way thing, because the message goes across through the post or through the print or wherever it is, the people at the other end don't have a chance to ask questions back. And therefore, the writing somehow has to be much clearer, much less ambiguous than speech can be. Let's take the final point, which is to do with grammar and style. Now, if we listen to speech, we hear that it's full of unfinished sentences, and the style and the kind of grammar that's used is much less complex, generally, than it is in writing. Let's just take an example. If you ask me a question like, what's the point of studying history? I might reply, well, that's an interesting question. Yes, I'm glad you asked me that. Well, I think one of the most valuable lessons we can learn from history is that it can help us to kind of understand. And so I might go on without actually getting to the point, and then maybe get to the point and give my information. In writing, all that hesitation, all that time spent not finishing sentences and thinking about things is taken up by sitting down with a pen on the table, or maybe nothing happening until we're ready to go, and then we'd write. Studying history can, and then think a bit longer, continue the sentence, help us to understand the causes of current events, and so we might then go on. In other words, getting the message from something that's written can often be done much more quickly than getting the message from something that's spoken. In other words, from the hearer's point of view or from the reader's point of view, the kind of information you're getting comes at quite a different pace. And the paces are also different from the producer's point of view, from the writer's point of view or the speaker's point of view, except those are reversed. If you want to say something, it doesn't take very long compared with the time it takes to write it. If you want to read something, it takes less long than the time it takes to listen to it. So there's an efficiency thing involved here. It's to do with the question of writing being something which is thought about, planned, and which is something that has to communicate with people in an ambiguous way, where the people haven't got a way of coming back to you and asking questions. Well, in speech, normally they do have a chance to ask questions, so now's the time for you. Any questions?
Section D. You'll hear 15 short extracts of spoken English. Follow the instructions in your book. The first is done for you as an example. 1.
Yeah, I know it doesn't look very good, but, I spent literally hours on it, honestly, and then I asked Mr. Brown, and he said it was perfectly all right, so, I mean, if you're happy with it.
Two.
Hey, you know, Tony, well, listen to this. Apparently, he and Tracy are going on holiday together, which is incredible, because everyone thinks he's about to get engaged to Fiona.
3.
Right, the deadline for handing in the assignments is July the 7th, but if any of you want to give them in ahead of that date, please don't hesitate. So has everyone got that? July the 7th.
4.
And so Ferdinand Magellan set sail in 1519 with a crew of 150 men, sailed round the world and was the first European to circumnavigate the earth.
5.
Sorry, if I could come in here. In fact, Ferdinand Magellan didn't actually get all round the world because he was killed by hostile natives in the Philippines. He was the first European to sail across the Pacific Ocean, but it was his second in command, Del Cano, with just 18 men out of the original 150, who were the first Europeans to actually sail all round the world. I think you'll find it.
6.
You see, the normal practice when we refer to historical figures is to talk about the leader or the captain or whatever. I mean, if you're talking about Napoleon marching on Moscow, it's understood that he had thousands of anonymous soldiers under his command, and we never get...
7.
If you get the facts wrong in an essay, you're sure to lose marks. So you need to be especially careful about dates and so forth.
8.
It might be a good idea to check your facts before you start writing, especially the dates. It's easy enough to look them up in a reference book.
9.
After waiting for a very long time, I started to feel rather uncomfortable, so I knocked at the door. And this strange young woman opened it. Well, you can imagine how embarrassed I felt. I mean, there was I standing.
10.
But I'm sure I said it right. Anyway, that meant I got stuck in rush hour traffic, so that's why I'm...
11.
Yeah, sure, I said I'd do it, but I just forgot. I know you were relying on me and all that, but... I'm sorry, I just couldn't be helped. Still, I'm really...
12.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I thought it was a very good film. Oh, by the way, how's your work going? Last time we met, you were feeling a bit fed up and thinking of leaving. Do you remember?
13.
And about your present job? Why are you thinking of leaving? What are your reasons for leaving this?
14.
Happy about it. I think it'd be better for all of us if you spent a little less time.
15.
So, the fat man said to the thin man, "Why did you jump so high?" And the thin man said to him, "Well, if I hadn't done that, you'd be flat on."
That's the end of side 2.